Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com coming up on this Monday edition of Trumpet Radio Live. It's unseasonably cool for a large part of the U.S., and it's going to be for the rest of August, so that might be a good thing if you like cooler weather. We have a list of the most and least trusted news sources. Might be a little bit surprised at some of those. Also, loneliness is more deadly than obesity, they say. And can Los Angeles afford to host the Olympics? Well, they're going to do it one way or the other. That and more coming up this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for joining us in those places. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. Also, if you'd like to email us, send those to comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate getting those. Today's Monday. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. And anything exciting over the weekend? Abraham looks like you got a suntan.
Yeah, I went to Lake Arcadia. I don't think that's from the sun. It's from the chemicals in the water.
Chemical burn.
Yeah. No, it was fun, though. We just, the most interesting thing is my wife found out about this game they play in Japan on the beach. You have a watermelon and on, like, the sand. We had it on, like, a towel. One person is blindfolded with a stick, and they have to hit the watermelon and break it open. But you have two people, one yelling at them the right instructions, the other person yelling at them the false instructions. And so you're trying to, it's just a game to see how quickly the watermelon can get smashed. And so we had many interesting gazes at us while we were doing this, people staring at us. And it was fun, though, but it was interesting.
Yeah, when you were describing this, I thought if I was walking by and saw that, I think I would hurry the kids into the car.
Yeah.
Now let's get out of here.
We wait until after the sheriff left to do it. So
wise decision. This watermelon is for everybody. It sounds like trying to break a pinata, sort of.
Basically, it's the same idea, just a little different, yeah.
And there's no candy inside.
Yeah.
And you're being deceived in the process.
Yeah. Somebody's a liar. Who's
except
the liar here?
Except it's healthy. It's watermelon.
Yes, that's true. Well, yeah, those beach days, you might want to get them in while you can. It's going to get colder, according to this weather write-up here from the Daily Mail. They say, get ready for fall in temperatures, unseasonably chilly August ahead for the eastern two-thirds of the U.S., with 60 degrees for lows lasting up to 2 weeks. We've experienced that here. It's been quite cool. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily cold, but I mean, 85 for a high today, you know, this week in the 80s. We should be in the mid-90s this time of the year. So we're close to 5-10 degrees below normal. They used to say it was global warming, and then it got colder, so everyone said, climate change. It could go in either which way. But definitely cooler coming up this month.
Yeah, climate change is a pretty tricky conundrum, because it can always exist no matter what the facts and evidence say. It always changes shape so that it can still be wreaking havoc on all of us.
Everything changes in the physical realm. There's always change.
In the late 80s, something was El Nino.
Yeah.
And then it was El Nina because it cooled again.
Right.
And then now they're calling it global warming and climate change. It's the same thing. It's just different names of saying it through the decades, I guess.
Whenever I think of El Nino, back in the 90s, Saturday Night Live, they did a parody of the weather forecast with Chris Farley. You might remember him. And he was El Nino. He was El Nino. He came on and he was like, I am El Nino. I don't know why that's funny, but it sure is.
That that's hilarious.
Yeah, it was very funny. He was a funny guy. Cooler temperatures, though. New York City, they say, likely to see showers and cloudy skies for most of the day. Today, temperatures are likely to stay in the high 60s. And so that's the weather you can expect here for August in the, what do they say, two-thirds of the U.S. eastern. So it was hot in the West Coast, cooler everywhere else. So can't be normal anywhere. It's always going to be odd, I guess. So that's some of the weather that's going on, and you're probably experiencing some of that if you're listening. Here, of course, over there at 101.3 or online at kpcg.fm all around the world. Here's a write-up from Reuters. They're talking about some of these sanctions the U.S. put on China, or Russia, rather. It says Russia aims to cut dependence on U.S. payment system. Russia will speed up work on reducing its dependence on U.S. payment systems and the dollar as a settling currency in response to U.S. sanctions. RIA news agency cited Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rabkov as saying on Monday. So if you know a lot about the U.S. economy and the global economy, or a little bit, I suppose, you probably know that the U.S. dollar is sort of the global currency. People need to trade in dollars usually. And that's what keeps us afloat, even as we print and do other things. But other nations are looking at different systems to avoid sanctions and other things. So if they do more of this, it definitely will hurt the U.S. Dollar and the economy.
Yeah, well, I think it's showing the general trend of a lot of nations, especially in Asia and Europe, where the U.S., they might not have the same political influence, but the dollar is still a pretty powerful tool to leverage political action, because if you don't trade in U.S. dollars, it can get really expensive, especially for a nation like Russia that is already struggling financially. They have a lot of oil and natural gas, but the rest of their economy isn't that great. So if they can use a different reserve currency, trade in euros or the Chinese yen or something like that, especially since Europe and China are their two biggest trading partners, I believe, they won't be dependent on the U.S. The U.S. can't sanction them as well, and they have a little more autonomy from what the U.S. thinks about them. So that seems like that's the general trend, and it's a dangerous one for the U.S. because if we lose the dollar and our leverage, that means we have to use military force, and we're too broke to really do any of those things anymore.
Yeah, we're hurting economically in a lot of ways, and Grant has a story later about the Olympics actually coming to Los Angeles. That can be exciting, but it's so expensive. What they had the Olympics in Brazil. That was the last Summer Olympics, and there's been plenty of stories about how they're broke. They were broke before they did it. They came in there and built all this infrastructure, and then now it's just sitting in ruins. So the Olympics can be a real boon to a local economy, but they can be a drain too. And so we'll talk about L.A. and what to expect there. I think the last time they had Olympics in L.A. was in 84, maybe?
I think so.
Yeah, those
sure that's right.
Before your time.
Yeah, so I wasn't even around to know.
Yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday. I was 6 years old. And, no, I mean, I have a vague memory of it occurring. I think I remember it because I've seen highlights of it. I don't think I actually remember it happening when it did. But so that's a story we'll look at here a little bit later. We have a story here, a list of the most and least trusted news sources. Kind of interesting to look at. They have quite a few on here. Any guess as to the least trusted news source in America? Some of these are big ones. Some of them are more obscure. But
Washington Post.
Let's see. It's one of those lists that is so small. I have to bring the computer. Like I tried to make it bigger and I couldn't. So
your face is touching the screen.
Almost. Yeah, I can barely see it. Yeah. Let's see. Where are they? They're in there, but they're actually one of the more trusted ones. Surprisingly, That shows you the state of our media. The least trusted news source is Occupy Democrats, which I've never even heard of, but people don't trust it.
Yeah, I think the name kind of gives it away.
Yeah. So least trusted here, we'll go from the least to the less least, if that makes sense. After Occupy Democrats, then it's BuzzFeed, followed by Breitbart. They're not trusted, although they have some pretty good write-ups sometimes. Social media in general is not trusted. I don't know. I don't really believe that. I think people know they're supposed to say that, but everybody goes to social media for info. They may not trust it, or they know they shouldn't, but it is a very popular source.
That's people's primary source. People all the time are saying that that's where they go first.
Yeah.
If you watch any video of people being asked what their news sources are, they'll all say social media.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder if they're referring to, because all the big news, Washington Post, all of them, they all have Twitter accounts or Facebook. It gets news. I wonder if they're just talking about unverified people putting news out there, and that's what they're listening to. That could be, that's kind of oddly specific, but that could be what they're talking about.
Donald Trump is not a trusted source of news. InfoWars is not trusted. Yahoo is not trusted. Internet in general. Internet. All of these are on the internet. That's a weird thing to say. It's like saying I don't trust words.
So InfoWars is more trusted than Breitbart.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly, right? Huffington Post is not trusted. The Blaze is not trusted. Fox News, they say, is not trusted, which is interesting. I don't know who they polled on this. Rush Limbaugh is not trusted, they say. ABC, MSNBC, Drudge Report. Oh, come on. NBC, CNN, CBS. Those are all not trusted. They come down in the least trusted, you know, group. Which I don't really... I wonder who they asked about this.
A lot of leftists, it sounds like.
It must be, because a lot of those sources are looked at, particularly, let's say, Drudge or somebody. And that's so funny, too. They'll say Drudge isn't trusted. He's just linking other articles.
Right.
He's not writing them. He's just linking them. And
yeah,
a lot of times, they are pretty good. I mean, I think almost anybody in the West... If there's breaking news, where do you go? Drudge?
Probably.
Just to see, because he's going to link to stuff. I would think that's the case.
That's equivalent to saying you don't trust the internet in general, because yeah, he's literally linking to the whole internet for all of his stories.
Yeah, I just wonder even if people were honest about this, if they just kind of put down what they think, you know, shouldn't be trusted. Because if you look at the most trusted, we'll just do it from the bottom to the top, I guess. So the first one is trusted, but not as much as the top one, if that makes sense.
Okay.
At the Atlantic, USA Today, New York Times, Kansas City Star, Seattle Times, Time Magazine, Washington Post, Denver Post, Associated Press, Politico, local news, just a general one there, I guess, Dallas Morning News, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, Guardian, PBS, NPR, BBC, Reuters, Public Television, The Economist, most trusted.
The Guardian's in the top like 10.
Yeah.
Almost all of those lean pretty far left, too.
Sure. NPR, PBS, I don't know. I mean, they're pretty liberal.
You know what those sources do, though, is they refuse to ever admit their bias. A lot of conservative sites readily admit that they are a conservative news site. It's in the tagline at the top of the page. But all these other ones act like they're mainstream right down the center when they really aren't. And a lot of people are fooled into believing that.
Yeah, I think that's probably the thing I've noticed. Say, I don't watch a lot of PBS NewsHour. If you really want to bore your kids beyond words, turn on PBS NewsHour. but, you know, I'll turn it there occasionally, and they have some interesting pieces at times. But I think you're right, Grant. They present themselves like they're just very neutral, but their stories all certainly lean certain ways. But they put on a show of being just very neutral in their personal standings, but the reporting isn't that way.
Yeah, I did. A lot of newspapers are higher than like news stations, TV stations, which maybe isn't a big surprise, but especially with how newspapers, there's the online version as well, but they're going out of popularity. That is kind of surprising in a way, especially with a lot of those newspapers having to retract stories. I'm surprised Rolling Stone's not number one, actually. but a lot of retracting stories or a lot of controversy, it seems like their reputation is untarnished, while a lot of the other ones in the same boat are lower. It's interesting. There isn't a whole lot of logic to the way it was thought through, I guess.
Well, it's probably more along the lines of what news do I dislike hearing, and that is what I trust the least. I think a lot of emotion gets into polls like that. If you don't like hearing something that favors the other side than the one you're on, then you're probably going to think it's not trustworthy.
Yeah, I would think a lot of this is also peer pressure. You know, if you were in a group of people that you thought were kind of news hounds, and if somebody asked you, what do you look at? And if you said, well, I look at Drudge or Fox, you'd probably get booed. But if you said MSNBC, you'd probably also get a little bit of that. But if you say, hey, PBS, that's kind of like, what? I think I don't know that people watch it, but I think it's considered more trustworthy or more neutral or something like that. But I still would think most people that said that they found that trustworthy, I don't think they go there. I think they check their Twitter feed.
Right.
Probably. Yeah. That's just where people are going for information. So
yeah, I'm surprised ESPN isn't up there too. Just, I don't know, just... I don't know what the parameters of the poll was, but it is, I think a lot of people just, they put down what's popular, but they also, it shows probably the limited scope of how they look at news. Because I think a lot of people, they look at news, but they're not searching for it. They just let it come to them. And so they're not actually really thinking about how to get it. They're just allowing it to pour into their Twitter feed or whatever is on the TV at the time.
And who actually searches five or six or seven sources about the same subject? I don't think that happens very much. So whichever article they stumble upon first is probably usually going to be the one that they take their opinion from. And yet, a lot of the time, as we've seen, these different outlets, they have their biases either direction. And so you can't just take exactly what the first article you see says as gospel.
Well, and I think that's even generous. I don't think people even read the full article.
Yeah, just skim it, headline.
You look at the bounce rate on web pages and articles, and it's, you know, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, whatever it is. I'm guilty. Guilty as charged with a lot of things. I mean, unless I find it really, really interesting, I'll usually just kind of, you know, like even this morning, you know, you check the headlines. What's the top headline? North Korea vows thousands of times retribution against the U.S. or whatever. Yeah. I mean, okay.
It's the same old thing.
Same old thing. Why don't they say a billion? I mean, why thousands, billions? I don't know. You know, so there's a lot. And it's not to say it's not an important story, but I mean, you know, you kind of see the big headlines. And I think a lot of news sites know that, so they just hit you with the headline knowing that's probably what you're going to read. Take the Russia scandal, right? What does anybody even really know about it?
Nothing.
Probably nothing other than you know it's in the news, right? Because you see the headline.
And it's horrible. It's the worst scandal of all time.
And it has to be stopped at all costs. What has to be stopped? Well, I don't know. You know,
we must resist.
Something with Russia doing something. I can't let them do that anymore, whatever it is. So that's an interesting look. You know, I do think, though, it kind of is, say if you ask somebody, what's the greatest movie, you know, of all time? I think people kind of would think about what people have said the greatest movie is, and they'd throw some of those out there. But if you compare that to what do people actually watch in general, it probably would be a very different list. Because you want to seem like, no, I Gone with the Wind, you know. But you probably aren't watching that. So I wonder if the news, this news thing is kind of like that, where you know something would make you seem intelligent or well-researched, but you probably don't look at that. That would be my guess on this.
Yeah, there is a bit of superficial culture where people know the right answers to questions to make them look, give the appearance that they're cultured, they're well-read, or they support one side or the other. But in reality, it's much different. So it is interesting to see how the trend is, and it probably those, that especially that poll, it does seem to give each other a pat on the back with all their friends. Like if it was a more liberal person who polled it, they want to make their friends look better than their enemies. So that kind of goes into that too, probably.
As far as what people are watching, you probably won't be surprised to find that people are watching Netflix quite a bit on their phones. And in June 2017, the amount of minutes watched was up 73% from the same time in 2014. More content, more people with access to it. In June of 2017, people watched 7,500,000,000 minutes of Netflix on their phones. That's a lot of time. And that was just three guys. Obviously, that's everyone. That's a lot of minutes. I haven't done the math, but how many days, how many weeks are we talking here?
It's a lot. All the binge watching and plus all the commercials saying, well, any little spare time you have, if you're on the bus, if you're traveling somewhere, you can just watch on your phone.
Right.
And it's people are really, any spare moment they're not working or doing something like important, they're on their phones watching Hulu or Netflix or whatever the streaming service is.
And even when they are working and doing something important, they're probably on those devices as well. That's a lot of time. Here's another note not related to that, but you might find interesting if you like very hot foods. Either of you guys like really hot stuff?
Not really.
Yeah.
Once in a while, I like to try it, but on general, no.
Not your thing.
The challenge is exciting,
yeah.
But usually I don't like to have really spicy foods in front of a lot of people because then you're just embarrassing yourself in front of a lot of people, going through all that pain.
That's right. You don't know what'll happen. Well, for those that love it, you might pay attention to Tabasco. They have a new scorpion sauce. It's 20 times hotter than their regular sauce. That number seems sort of arbitrary to me. Like, I don't know how is it. I'm sure that's actual. You know, I know they have a heat scale, but I don't know exactly what that means. Does it kill you? Like what? Some people like Tabasco. Some people do not. If you like it and you just think, man, I just wish this was hotter, which if you eat it a lot, I suppose you get a little bit desensitized. You'd like a little more kick. The scorpion sauce is 20 times hotter. I wonder if there's a warning on that. Because that could do some damage to somebody.
Yeah, we could probably learn a lot about that just from the name. It's called Scorpion, so maybe it's like the equivalent of poison coursing through your veins. Maybe it's about that painful or deadly.
It could be, yeah. You see that story today about that Australian teen who was soaking his feet there in the water in Australia?
Yeah.
And these little tiny sea creatures ate basically the skin off his legs and feet.
Yeah.
The pictures are horrific. What?
They're called sea lice, I think.
Yeah.
His legs are just bloodied up because they just came and started skinning him.
His parents, the next night, went back to the same location. I think they put some meat inside of a net and put it in there, and the same sort of thing happened. So they, from what I understand, they're not really familiar with this type of sea lice, but it's meat eaters. Obviously, one wouldn't probably cause you too much trouble, but you get a ton of them, you're going to have problems. So anyway, you got to be careful out there. That's why, Australia has always got the deadliest animals. Even the lice will eat you.
We keep hearing of new creatures from there that have caused someone great pain or heartbreak or struggle of some sort. And it's like we thought we knew the extent of how dangerous it was there, and then something new pops up in the headlines.
Yeah. Yeah, I was telling you before we came on the air, I went to the zoo over the weekend. Haven't been there in a while, and it was great. They're doing a lot of nice things there. And one of the weirdest things that I saw, and this is a very common sort of animal, I guess, but the anteater. And I just looked at that thing and thought, what in the... Look at that thing.
Yeah.
I thought, if I was in the woods just minding my own business and I saw that thing, I don't know what I would do.
So true.
I'm not aware of, like, the danger level for me, personally. I would try to get away from it. Like, this is one of the most bizarre-looking things.
Well, you also discover how deeply Oklahoman your kids are, too, right?
Yeah, because out of all the things that are there, and there's a lot of neat animals and elephants and all kinds of things, and the biggest thing they wanted to do was go feed the catfish. That was the highlight, like, the whole time. It's like, so are we going to feed the catfish? I'm like, yeah, sure, we'll get over there.
You know the next step for them is sticking their hand in and catching it with their bare hand? Going noodling, the state sport or something?
No, I know. I never heard of that until I moved here, and then somebody was telling me about it, and I was like, wow, that seems strange. And then I saw a documentary on it. It was a very poorly done documentary, but I couldn't stop watching it.
Right.
I watched the whole thing. It was about these people that would stick their arms, go noodling, and then, and if the listeners aren't aware of that, basically they stick their arm down in a catfish nest or whatever they call them, and they bite on and they just pull it out.
Yeah, apparently there's a gigantic tournament here every year, every summer in Paul's Valley. And it always attracts about 20,000 spectators, and obviously they have all the stands up selling goods, and it's a pretty big event that I only recently found out about, so I'm pretty tempted to try to go next year.
I just don't know, how was that discovered? You know, I'm just going to stick my arm down here and see what bites, and I'll pull it out. If it was me, I would just get a pole of some kind.
Right.
Like, bite the pole, don't bite my arm. But and then people get bit by snakes, so there's snakes down in there too sometimes, and so... that was at the documentary I saw. That was the big dilemma. There was a big tournament coming up, and the guy got bit by a snake, and he was like, should I go back? Shouldn't I? So that was...
No, you shouldn't.
As I sat there, I couldn't turn away from this noodling thing. But yeah, so no, they didn't want to do that yet. They just wanted to throw feet in and watch them jump over each other to eat it. Mm-hmm. And then the exciting thing was the ducks are there too, so it's a contest. You think the duck's going to get it, and then the catfish jumps up and eats it. And so even though they like the same food, they seem to be able to handle themselves okay. As my wife pointed out, the terrifying thing is the water seems calm and like there's nothing there. And then you throw the feet in, all of a sudden there's about 500 catfish. You're like, whoa! You don't know what's under the water sometimes. That's what makes me nervous. Speaking of toxic waste. Toxic waste from U.S. pot farms alarms experts. We were talking about the marijuana, you know, medical marijuana, plus now it's legal in a lot of states. But making it, there's a lot of toxic waste from it. Pollution from illegal marijuana farms deep in California's national forests is far worse than previously thought. It's turned thousands of acres into waste dumps so toxic that simply touching plants has landed law enforcement officers in the hospital. So that's a bad, bad deal. They're using fertilizers that are illegal and outlawed.
Well, yet another problem with marijuana and other types of drugs that we hear about. I was in California a couple months ago, and the person who was taking me out in the city there, he was saying, you know, we just walked through, it was like a cloud of marijuana, because it was just like this pungent, just putrid smell. And it's just, even that, it's just you wonder how people are able to ingest something like that when it leaves behind just a cloud of smoke. It's just a disgusting habit. Even if it's not dangerous, it's just an unattractive habit to have.
Yeah. Some of these fertilizers and pesticides that are being used are, like this article mentions, are banned in the United States. It includes carbofuran and zinc phosphide. So I don't know if people are familiar with that or not, but those are banned. So they're dumping a lot of this stuff in there. And I suppose people that would argue for legalizing it would say, well, hey, if you legalize it, then you can monitor what they're putting on this stuff. But a lot of these marijuana farms here that they're talking about are deep in forested areas in California. I think some of it's even on federal land. But they're producing a lot of the stuff that's being sold. So even if it's being sold legally, it's being made in this pretty nasty way, so bad that it's causing these toxic dumps to be left behind. So anytime what you're consuming leaves behind a toxic situation, probably think twice about whether you should consume it or not.
That concerns anyone when we're talking about just regular foods. But for some reason, when it comes to this drug, it's above reproach.
Yeah, really bad situation there. Abraham, you've got a story for us from the Telegraph about loneliness. They say, I feel like I should play some sad music. loneliness, they say, is deadlier than obesity, according to a study. So, and it's interesting, too, actually. There's an article in the most recent Time magazine about depression and people trying to get on different medications for it and so forth. But a lot of the medications don't work, or they're very expensive. And they don't really solve anything. It's kind of you're kind of just taking drugs, basically. But they said that if people are positive and they think positively and they're in that mind frame, they're a lot healthier physically. Cardiovascular health, everything's better. I think people know that. It's kind of a common thing. If you're a happy person, if you have a lot of joy, you feel better physically. And this study kind of backs that up, that if you're the opposite way, you're going to have some deadly consequences.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty comprehensive, this study. Researchers in the U.S. looked at 218 studies that look at the health effects of social isolation and involved about 4 million people. So this isn't a small study. It's pretty comprehensive. And I think this kind of falls on what we've been talking about last week with teenagers and the huge problem with depression and suicide. A lot of it caused from using smartphones and screen time and social media. And just a lot of other areas. I think the World Health Organization released a study saying depression is the world's leading cause of bad health as well. So this all falls in line with a lot of these other things we've talked about. And they found that lonely people have a 50% increased risk of an early death compared to those with good social connections. And obesity raises the chance of dying early by only about 30%. So just the mental state of being lonely and usually leading to depression and other things leaves you dying before the age of 70. I think that's what they call an early death, 50%. And it has other health effects as well. When you're depressed or lonely, it does release certain proteins and everything into your blood, and it increases your chance of a cardiac arrest or a heart attack or a stroke because these proteins build up in arteries and everything like that. So it's not just a mental state; it actually has profound effects on your heart and on your health. And it is found that a lot of it is older people. If they have family around them or friends or people who visit them a lot, they live a lot longer than those who don't. But they also found, I think the most interesting part is that people between the ages of 17 and 34, between the ages of 18 and 34, they were 55% more likely to feel depressed than other people. So people between those ages are a lot more likely to be depressed than others in that age group. When you should be in the prime of your life, you should be getting married, should be pretty exciting because you're leaving college, you're starting your new life. But they're actually the demographic that is most depressed, even more so than elderly people, which I think is surprising. Mm. And so with this, it kind of correlates with other research that we've found where it seems like not just teenagers and adolescents, but the people in working ages are more depressed. Therefore, they're seeking medical aid like antidepressants or marijuana to combat that. And a lot of it, they found, is just based around positive mental attitude and having social connections. And by social connections, they mean physical interaction with people, talking to them, that sort of thing. It's not social media. It's not texting. It's not FaceTime even. It's having actual ties to people. So it is interesting. I think it just confirms what we've been talking about for a long time.
Do they give any indication as to why people in that 18 to 34 range are the most depressed?
No, they don't really go into that section of it. I think they, one reason they give, a researcher thinks they have less social skills than people who are older than them because of the way they were brought up. A lot of those people in those ages had the internet or they have smartphones and they have less social skills, so they just don't know how to interact with people as well as older generations.
Probably some anxiety, some fear about what are you going to do with your life and moving into adulthood. There can be some anxiety there, I suppose. I wonder, too, if a person is really depressed for that time period, if that affects them later. Like, you know, they may not drop dead at that point, but if it affects them, you know, in their 60s or something like that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even if you're just depressed for a time or feeling isolated, those health effects just from that one time period can have big effects on you later. High periods of stress at one point in your life can come back and have major effects on your heart and your blood pressure and everything later in life, even when that stress or the triggers of it are long gone. And so with this, it is interesting, and especially with the trend of adolescents being more depressed, this is only going to get worse. And so, and they don't really have any solutions for it. None of the researchers or anyone really have any solutions besides saying, well, we need more classes in college about how to interact with people, when that's not really the solution at all.
Yeah, there's some other numbers kind of related to just depression in general here. It says, this is from Time, their big write-up on the depressants and the antidepressants. They say that 6.7% of people in the U.S. Have depression, according to their numbers. 30% of people with depression don't get better after they have two or more treatments of some sort of pharmaceutical help, I guess. And they say usually it takes 1 to 2 months for most antidepressants to work, so people get on these different drugs. And so they're trying the solution, I guess, in a lot of thinking is, well, we just need a new drug. You know, if this one doesn't work, let's make a new one. So they're making this new one, ketamine, I believe it is. They say 368 people who have participated in the U.S. studies of ketamine for depression so far. This is this new drug. It takes, the effects of it, if you take this drug, that says it usually lasts 7 to 14 days. So hopefully you'll be happier for a week to 2 weeks. You know what it costs? So every time you take the drug, $600.
Oh.
That'll make you sad inside.
From those stats you mentioned, too, that sounds like about 20 million people in this country are depressed. That's just hard to even fathom that there are that many people going through their daily lives, not even wanting to get out of bed in the morning, just dreading every single aspect of what they have to go through each day. That's just a horrible way to live. And there are just so many people who live like that, and maybe they do a decent job of hiding it, but still, that's just inner turmoil that pretty much cripples most people that it affects.
Yeah, these people are trying to, this new, again, ketamine, which is an injection, which lasts 1 to 2 weeks. They say the treatments are rarely covered by insurance. They run from $400 to $800 per infusion on a biweekly schedule. At the high end of going rates, that adds up to more than $15,000 a year. So how can you afford that? But one thing they mention here that does help people with depression is exercise. Mm-hmm. Move around, do something that helps people feel better. It is a serious, serious issue, and so it has, besides just mental effects, it does have health effects there, as that other article points out as well. So pretty interesting about depression. Related to exercise, here's a list of the most and least active countries in the world. The least active is Indonesia. Get with it, Indonesia. People don't move around much. They're the least active. They base this on the data from people's smartphones, you know, how much they walk around. The U.S. comes in 30th place, number one, Hong Kong. They're the most active. So they take the most steps per day, 6,880. Depends on where you are, I guess. Some people, just your daily life requires movement, and others it doesn't require it as much. So Russia comes in at number five. They're ahead of us as well.
Wow. Well, Russia's a big country.
Well, you walk across the country.
Yeah, when I went to school, we had to walk through Siberia, uphill both ways to school. That's what they say in Russia. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here at 101.3 KPCG. Kia David program's coming up. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Stop and check out thetrumpet.com. The real Russia scandal. Vladimir Putin is sowing division within the United States to keep America from becoming the next energy superpower. That's by Andrew Miller there at thetrumpet.com. Related to that, the Russian alliance you really have to worry about by Richard Palmer. So stop and check out those articles. Grant, you've got a write-up here from Spectator. Going for broke? Can Los Angeles afford to host the Olympics? In other words, will LA still be solvent come 2028?
Yeah, this is just kind of raining on their Olympic parade. It's kind of a sad state of affairs there in LA because they're going to try to pay $5.3 billion or $1,400 per resident of the city to host the Olympics in 2028. That $5.3 billion projection, though, is for 11 years from now. There's a great chance that number goes up astronomically in 11 years. But even if we're talking that low number, that's still a lot of money per person to spend on the Olympics. And they're saying that it's not going to be from extra taxes that they raise this money. It's actually going to be from sponsorships. The problem with that is that pretty much every Olympics has not given much of a return on the investment for the host city or country.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm sure there's a lot that goes into it, but that just seems like a lot of money to have to put into it. I mean, you think about the events of a Summer Olympics, and they got some gyms there, don't they? You got a few stadiums already. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more to it than I realize, but I just wonder where all that money's going to.
Yeah, it's hard to figure that out. Hopefully, in LA's case, it would seem like they have a lot of different stadiums. They're even building a new one right now for a new soccer team, their second soccer team in the city. So it would seem like they have a lot of infrastructure already in place because of all the sports teams they already have there. But even still, we're talking $5.3 billion, probably a lot more over the next 11 years. And that might seem sustainable if LA were anywhere close to a balanced budget right now, but really they're not. We talked about last week how illegal immigrants there are spending $3 for every, or they're making $3 in welfare for every dollar they're actually spending. That's a $2 billion plus burden on the city in the last 2 years. They're spending so much money on things like that that they don't have money for the Olympics.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. There's a lot of, I mean, people want to do a lot of things like this. There's a lot of projects that are pretty exciting, like the Olympics, but you do need the money for it. And, I don't know. I guess you just go further into debt to pay for it. Because I don't think anyone really thinks they're actually going to have the money on hand.
No.
When's the last time the money's been on hand for anything? It seems like not in a long time.
Yeah, that is a stressful thing to think about, just the way that this entire country really is built on so much staggering amounts of debt. Even just the per person debt is $10,000 or even possibly more than that per person. It's hard to even figure out how things operate when we're talking about that much debt. The LA school district is probably going to be broke by 2020 and have a $600 million budget deficit by that time. And so if we're talking 8 years after that, the deficit surely would be a lot more. It's just they have a lot of issues like this. Their pensions in 2003 in the city were only 3% of the city's expenditures, but now it's 20% for the pensions. Pensions which, of course, are not fully funded. They're not going to be paying these people who have retired what they have been promised, and yet they're going to go into debt trying to.
Yeah, Well, if other projects kind of get sidetracked, I don't know what to do with the schools, but if there are other shortfalls and people aren't getting what they would hope for, it would be kind of a slap in the face, I guess, to have your city put on the Olympics and knowing what they're spending with. Yeah. Maybe you're not getting what you need for local education or things like that. And, you know, I mean, we've seen in the last few Olympics, particularly when they've been in Russia and in China, you know, nations really try to show off and say, hey, look at how big we are, how powerful we are. And, you know, they have all these amazing things happen there. And we're still trying to do that. But the reality is we're not as powerful as we used to be. We just don't have the money.
And the debt is making the country more and more shaky, even as we try to project power, the rare times we actually do. Even just L.A. alone has a $224 million deficit. So even though there is an amount of prestige that comes with hosting the Olympics, where does the money come from? I don't know if anyone can really figure that out. It's just it's such a confounding scenario. Someone here, president of the Homeowners Association in L.A., said, if we have a catastrophe like an earthquake or rioting, the city is going to have problems, problems that, you know, could make it impossible to operate the city.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder why he brought up rioting. Is that a concern that they have? Apparently it is.
It seems like it. There have been obviously some demonstrations against the president in the area in L.A. County. I believe that's where UC Berkeley is, I'm pretty sure. Even if not, Long Beach State and a lot of other big colleges out there have had demonstrations. I don't know if they've all turned violent as much as UC Berkeley's had, but that alone cost, what was that, like $100 million in damages on UC Berkeley's campus, or I think it was around that area. And that's just an area where, you know, they just let the police stand down, and then the rioters are allowed to destroy things, costing yet more money for the city that the city doesn't have.
They've been talking, I don't know about if they've been serious or not, but they have been talking about seceding, right? I don't think anyone thinks that will actually happen, but maybe this will be their first Olympics as a host country by themselves,
right?
The country of California. And I was thinking too about different Olympic teams. They could have a what do they call those cities over there now? The word escapes me. Where they let everybody come
sanctuary
in.
Sanctuary cities.
Thank you. Yeah. Sanctuary cities. So you could have a sanctuary city team. People from all places, just randomly living in these cities. No one knows where they're from, you know, because every country's got their team that shows up. So we could have a sanctuary city team in the Olympics.
Well,
they would lose badly, I think.
they would win if you had any, like, absurdly violent contests. They would definitely triumph in those.
The affirmative action Olympics. Everybody's getting medals.
Yeah, that's right. There are obviously, like we said, there are 4 million illegals just in LA County alone. That is probably a very, very low estimate just to make the state look better than it actually is. Even the state itself has a $3.3 billion budget deficit right now. So LA can't expect to get bailed out by Sacramento, the state's capital. Where is the state going to get the money from? And if the state doesn't have the money, does the country have the money? No, we're $20 trillion in debt. So I just don't know how these things get financed. It's definitely beyond my intellect.
Yeah, it's a constant issue in this country right now is the debt and the debt limits and all of that. So, well, that'll be interesting to see if what happens by 2028. Well, we're talking 11 years down the road here. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, they like to plan these things for down the road. We'll see what LA looks like in 2028. But anyway, interesting story there. Yesterday, Sunday, marked the 72 years since the world's first nuclear attack on Hiroshima, with the nation's traditional contradictions over atomic weapons again coming into focus. So they had some memorial events there, I guess. And related to that, Abraham, you have a write-up here from foreignpolicy.com, an argument that somebody's making. The bomb didn't beat Japan, they say. Stalin did. And they say, have 70 years of nuclear policy been based on a lie?
Yeah, this is an interesting argument they make, and it should make us think about this event, because every year when the anniversary of the first nuclear bombs or atomic bombs, I should say, being used, it is always a moment to ponder and to think about what has happened since then. And the argument always comes up every year where they, was it ethical for us to do so, or Japan was going to surrender anyway, those sort of things. Well, this author, Ward Wilson, they make a different argument. And this is from an article a few years ago. But basically, he believes that the bombs did not compel Japan to surrender. It was the possible invasion of the Soviet Union into Japan. And he based most of his argument on the meetings that the Supreme Council had in Japan. The Supreme Council met on August 6th to consider surrender before they knew about Hiroshima. And then they didn't meet until after Nagasaki had been hit, and they met before they found out about Nagasaki. So the times when the Supreme Council met, it wasn't really the logical times you think they'd meet, especially with these nuclear attacks on our cities. I think that's, you can't just use those council meetings and the records to think that that's the only thing the government was thinking when it comes to surrender and war policy. It is an interesting point, though. And with the Soviets, it is a good point, and I think it was considered by Japan. There are some diary entries from top generals saying that the Soviet Union will decide the fate of the empire. Because with all of Japan's resources facing southeast, fighting the United States, the back door was open to the Soviet Union to invade Manchuria in China and then cross the Sea of Japan into Japan. And they almost had no forces to oppose them if Stalin chose to do that, which begs the reason, well, why didn't Stalin do that in the first place? And that's because Stalin signed a non-aggression pact with Japan that would expire in 1946. So Japan was trying to weigh all these things in the balance. Well, the Soviets could attack in 1946 or sooner, because Soviets were technically a neutral power with Japan, even though they were allied against Germany with the United States. So it is an interesting argument. I think that was part of the considerations of the Japanese high command. At the same time, I think this argument does seem to take away the destructive legacy of the atomic bombs, and seems to marginalize their use, and makes it seem that if they were used again, it wouldn't be a big deal. To me, I think that's the danger of this argument, because he does say, Ward Wilson, that and it is true that the conventional bombing of America on Japan was about the same tonnage. It killed around the same amount of people as the two atomic bombs. But that was over a period of 4 years. And also that basically that the Japanese, they were trying to shrug off the nuclear attacks and keep fighting, especially the hardliners in the military. And I think they would have kept fighting if the emperor didn't intervene sooner. So basically, that's his argument, is that the Soviet Union, the threat of invasion, is more of the reason behind the Japanese surrender than the two atomic bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is why I believe, based on other arguments, other books read on the subject, is that this was a part of the consideration, but that the military were going to fight to the death. In fact, they had Japan basically became a fortress because they wanted to inflict such high casualties on the Americans that they would get better terms if they surrendered than if they did in the beginning of August 1945. And a lot of the in Japanese warrior culture, it's dishonorable to surrender. So especially a lot of the hardliner generals wanted to fight to the death, basically. And the American military projected about 1 million dead if America did attack. And that's Americans' casualties, not Japanese. So it would have been the most grotesque battle of the entire war if it did happen. And that's part of why President Truman allowed these attacks to come. And so I think if you look at the grand scale of things, and in fact, the New Yorker piece on Hiroshima, I forget the author, Ed Hershey, is that his name? But he went to Hiroshima and wrote about the effects of it. If you read about that, there's no way you can minimize this effect on the morale of the Japanese people. And realizing that 10 more of those bombs could come in your country, basically make it a nuclear wasteland. I think that's kind of a naive opinion of history of mine to think that those didn't have a huge psychological effect on forcing the Japanese to surrender, especially when in their culture, those generals would have rather die than surrender.
Yeah, when you read about what happened there after that bomb dropped, I mean, they were in the midst of, the Japanese were tearing down houses to build fire lanes because the Americans were bombing them. They were used to being bombed. It did kill people, but they understood the weapon. And the fear and the dread that came when they did not understand what happened, you can't overestimate that. And it came in waves because there's a progression to the destruction of an atomic weapon. And they didn't understand it. Now, some of the scientists, I think, did up at the higher level, but the people on the ground did not. And if you look at the, as you mentioned, just the way the people were thinking at the time, the Japanese, they were going to fight to the death. Even those that were dying from the fallout of the atomic bomb, whether it was because something fell on them or whatever, and they had final moments there, there was reports of them just saying, well, we're just thankful we could die for our country and our emperor. Like they were going to fight to the death. And then even those that were affected by it for years afterwards, they would usually say, well, it couldn't be helped. You know, they weren't mad that the atomic bomb was dropped. They said, we were fighting. It was war. And it's the way it went. So, but that definitely had an impact. I mean, a huge impact because they didn't know what they were dealing with. And you can deal with a weapon if you understand it, but when you don't understand what's happening, it hugely impacted them.
Yeah, and if they had to experience more atomic bombs like that, it's certain that their whole country would have been exterminated from the face of the earth. Then you don't even have an option for surrender like you would against the Soviets. And if the Soviets came in, that's a nightmare as well, because who knows what they do to you if they, obviously, if they capture any of the Japanese soldiers. But from what I understand, probably a lot of the Japanese soldiers would have just killed themselves before surrendering. So it does, that's the kind of mindset they had, that where they really were going to go to all extremes to avoid looking weak, appearing like they were inferior. So they would have actually killed themselves before surrendering to the Soviets. The thing about the bombs is they wouldn't have had a country anymore. And I think they probably were so panicked about that there was really no other choice.
Well, and two, if the atomic bomb wasn't that big of a deal, why did everybody race to get it? They're still racing to get those weapons today, those that don't have them, because they know it's the great equalizer.
And why haven't we used it since? It's because it has such fearful effects on whoever it's used, and even on the global scale, like the radiation fallout and everything. So it's, I just think it's a, I don't know, you just can't minimize the impact that it had ushering the nuclear age, but also the entire Cold War for 50 years was based on nuclear armaments, the mutually assured destruction idea. If this wasn't a big deal, other strategic ideas would have been more important. And that's the argument he's making, that maybe our entire theory is wrong. But I don't think it is. And especially, I think his biggest problem here in Ward Wilson, based off of what I've read, is he's projecting American ideas of government, how they treat their people, onto the Japanese. And he said, like, well, think of their shoes. What would you do if you were in their shoes? Well, we don't know, because they think so much differently than us. And especially at that time, their military hierarchy was in complete control. The emperor was just a figurehead anyway, that there was no consideration for the people. They would have sacrificed the whole nation before surrendering to America if they weren't forced to by the most destructive weapons in the history of mankind. That's the kind of enemy Japan was, compared to maybe other ones. And so I think, and there's other evidence through the past 70 years that it was a landmark event. I mean, I think before anyone considers using nuclear weapons, they look back at Hiroshima and say, well, do we actually want to do this? Especially with the threat of retaliation now. Do we want our own cities to look like that? I think there's such a landmark event that to think that there was some other kind of strategic thinking behind their surrender just underestimates the Japanese, I think, as their ferocious spirit in fighting, but also minimizes the impact of a nuclear weapon. And especially in an age where Iran, all these other nations are looking to get atomic weapons or they have them, to minimize it, say, oh, it's not a big deal. It's almost saying, like, well, it's okay if Iran gets a nuclear weapon. To me, that's kind of the way of thinking this is going. And to me, that's very dangerous.
Yeah, and, well, a couple of things there. I mean, one, when they were testing the weapons, one of the guys, I forget who it was, that was there to see it, one of the first tests, he was horrified by what he saw, and he said, whoever the last person on Earth alive ever is, this is the last thing they'll see. Mm. They understood that they were unleashing something that was just uncontrollable to a point if it got out of hand there. And then what was the other thing I was going to say? Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at World War II, nations learned a lot. What did Germany learn? You can't go in and fight a city. You can't go in and fight Stalingrad because you're going to get your entire group obliterated probably. And even if you were able to get a victory, everyone's going to die trying. But if you drop one of those bombs, the problem's solved for you. So if they had it, they would have certainly used it, and they could have defeated Russia if they had those weapons, right?
Yeah.
But you can't go in and fight hand-to-hand in a city. It's just too hard to do it.
Well, exactly. In fact, most doctrine today from every major nation, including the United States, the United States will never do this probably, but other nations, a lot of their theories on how to wage an offensive war against a major power, not against a small nation, is to use a first nuclear strike, either to destroy infrastructure, city, or to create an EMP that will black out the enemy nation's infrastructure. So, I mean, China has a lot of military doctrine along those lines. All these other nations do as well. And so they do understand these lessons learned, that either you can use a nuclear bomb to completely decimate a whole country before you even have any troops on the ground, or you can use it at the same time with a more tactical nuclear strike. But all of that was learned from World War II, as you mentioned, and every major power has plans like that for when they're going to attack each other, contingency plans. And so it's foolish to think that those lessons weren't learned in World War II, or that there was some other more important factor at risk. Because listeners want to read the effects of Hiroshima, when you read it, you realize that nothing in the world has ever been seen like that. And it's something that was so different that the imaginary attack of the Soviet Union couldn't be as persuasive as what they saw on the ground in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah. Seems like the West that won that war is spending a lot of time sort of apologizing for it, and those that lost are thinking about how to win it the next time. That's all the time we have for today here on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. Kia David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show are coming up. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blundo, have a great rest of your Monday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.